and welcome to the Weekly Scroll Podcast. My name is Ryan.
And I'm your favorite wanderling with a funny accent.
And I'm Watt.
Again. Watt is here still. Again. Hello.
Consistently, how are you doing today, Watt?
Yeah. The strange growth on the show.
There you go.
You can't seem to lance.
No. I do think, I think you're our most guested guest. And I do think the combined episodes, I don't think we've talked about anything more. We have a review. I think this is the third interview. We had a playthrough. So we're on what, like 5 Clattermas episodes at this point?
Yeah, I did a playthrough, and then I think Meat Castle Christian did a playthrough. So
yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah, and that, yeah, that one too. Yeah.
So yeah. Wow, we did a lot of so long ago. The show.
Yeah. It really wasn't that long ago, but it feels like forever ago.
Yeah. We're huge fans, obviously. So thanks for coming back on. We're obviously stoked to have you back on. We've been talking for the past like 20 minutes. Although no one here watching knows that. So secret conversations.
I'm a big fan of the show, and it's always great to be on and watch and listen to your stuff.
We will always appreciate that, even though we'll never believe anyone ever listens to us. So you're here, and that means something's going on. So for those that might have their heads in the sand, what's going on with Cloud Empress right now?
So I'm best known for Cloud Empress. It's an ecological science fantasy role-playing game that uses the Mothership D100 Panic system, although it's entirely standalone, so you can use it compatible with Mothership content, or it has a free rulebook on DriveThruRPG you can use. But back again for the second Cloud Empress Kickstarter, it launched last Tuesday, so we're about a week into the campaign, and it's going really well. And the, I guess, idea of the campaign is to continue to expand the setting with 2 new setting books that we can talk more about, as well as doing a reprint of the first materials because they've been sort of selling really well. And also listening to sort of fan requests from the first campaign. So a lot of the reprints include a new storage solution, a collector's box in 2 different versions, as well as hardcover reprints that sort of combine the previous campaign in some new ways to make it a little bit more accessible for folks just hopping in or wanting a concise collection on their shelf.
We'd love a good box here on the show. Very excited. And we're not getting 1, we're getting 2, because obviously I'm getting both, even though I have them, but I'm very excited to have them in hardback. The slideshow above us, for those that are watching, if you look through there, you'll see both boxes, both sets, and gosh, they're stunning. That dark green box for the Life and Death box is absolutely beautiful, but you can obviously see that on the Kickstarter page as well. Go check it out. I just dropped the link into the chat. But storage solutions, always great. Always love a good box. What was the impetus to want to reprint the original starter set in hardback, though?
Sure. So at some point, I wanted to do the box set. It came up consistently that as people were getting their copies, I would say most folks don't have dedicated zine storage. Like probably we do. So I have a whole like Target wooden box system for zines. I love zines. They're probably my favorite TTRPG format generally. I love how you can throw them in a backpack and you don't feel bad if they get scratched up or dented or whatever, at least for me. I just love throwing them around. I mean, my copy of the Mothership book, Pound of Flesh, like is falling apart just because I carried it around for so long. But I wanted to do the box set so people could have a storage solution and keep it all together. The first Kickstarter campaign had, I believe, 8 zines, a bunch of postcards, a bunch of, there's a map and a bunch of stuff. So it was a really big amount of stuff that is sort of unrelated to keep a hold of. And it did come with like a bag, but it's just like an eco-friendly Ziploc bag. So it didn't look really great. So folks really wanted a box. One of the things I'm really committed to doing in the campaigns is not going too far off of what I plan for. I, as we've talked about in, I think, the last episode, the delivery of the project to me is as important as the game itself. It's a really big, important part to how people sort of receive the material and how they think about Cloud Empress. So that was the number one requested item for the first campaign was, we want a box. for a while, I explored this idea of doing like a tuck box, almost like a software box that would fold flat. So that was the first solution that I announced and got quotes on that, and it seemed like it was reasonable. But one of the other things I'm doing with the new campaign is moving to a external fulfillment partner called Quartermaster Logistics, which is one of these like larger board game, role-playing game fulfillment partners for a number of reasons. Save my back and you know, just create sort of a long-term plan for releasing these games that is gonna, I have stairs, like rickety stairs that I have to take up and down all these zines. So and there's snow in Minnesota. So anyway, all that's to say, the tuck box is really, really big when they're flat. So it would have been quite a large box that was really thin that would have been pretty expensive to ship despite this like low weight of the whole thing. So decided to do international manufacturing. And as part of that, as I was getting quotes for international manufacturing, I had at least one of my like top one or two vendors telling me that they couldn't do zines or saddle stitch or whatever you want to call it, staple bound books at 60 pages. There were only a few vendors that could do 60 page zines that I was going to work with on the first campaign. So it was one of these things where I felt like I'd be pretty limited in terms of manufacturing options if the campaign, you know, successfully funded or when it funded. And so that became sort of the impetus of like, okay, well, I know I really want to do this box. How do we move into that in a way that gives me options around the manufacturing side and making sure that we're making sort of a viable product? I did not want to go like perfect bound, like a soft cover book. Mm-hmm. I don't really like that format very much for role-playing games. I mean, it's okay, but they're pretty hard to fold open and hold open, those kinds of things. So the idea to do hardcover kind of came about pretty late in the sort of imagining of the project. And I had always planned a hardcover, I would say. But my original plan was to do sort of like a revised or second edition, maybe 5 to 7 years out, and then go in with a hardcover at that point. But the more I thought about it, the more it seemed to make sense for this release. But also wanted to acknowledge that the first books had just come out. People are still buying the first books. And so there were a couple things that I wanted to do to support folks and make them feel like they weren't obligated to get the hardcovers. And so the two pieces around that were creating the boxes so that they could fit all the previous content. So there's one pledge called the Life and Death box, which is that green skull box that you all might see that comes with two hardcover books, but you could fit all of your previous stuff in that box with the two new hardcovers. And so that's, hey, I don't want to repurchase any content I've already bought. There's a pledge level just for that. And the skull box is sort of the like crowdfunding promo box. That's the sort of one that's not going to be released in the future, at least through retail or any other you know, venues outside of crowdfunding. And then the other thing we did, or I did, was offering the sort of best discount I could on it. You know, if anybody's repurchasing content, either the starter box, which contains a lot of the materials from the first campaign, or you're doing one of the like sort of all-in pledges, you're getting a $5 or $8 discount that's applied sort of at some of the like shipping stages of things. So that was I don't like when you feel like something's become invalidated because something new came out, or I don't want people to feel like this is sort of a money grab or anything like that. It's sort of logistical limitations in manufacturing and feels like sort of the best business decision in terms of like manufacturing options.
I did not realize, like, small detail of all of that, but I did not realize that if I get the Life and Death box, when I get the Life and Death box, all of my other Cloud Empress stuff fits into that.
Yeah, that's been hard to explain, and I think if I had a little more money or time, I could have made some nice like 3D mock-up of everything like coming together. Mm. But I do all the graphic design and the mock-ups and stuff, so I'm still building the 3D skill. But yeah, the idea is that the both boxes are about 5 to 6 centimeters. I'm not sure exactly where they're going to land, so they're going to be about half full when you get them with the content in the game, unless you do the all books bundle. I think those will have like, the idea is either it's 4 hardcovers that fit in there or 2 hardcovers and then your previous zines should be about the same size.
That's awesome. I'm super stoked for that. I couldn't be more stoked for that.
I'm incredibly excited. Obviously, I'm re-getting everything because that's because I'm terrible with money.
Because Ryan.
But I think one of the things that I think even oh, because that's my name there on the Kickstarter page. I think even one of the things I said there specifically was like, as someone who is I back a ton of stuff, and as a backer, as someone who looks at games from like multiple angles and stuff, the thought that you put into what you make, why you make it, and who you're making it for is like one of my favorite things about you and about the project. So to specifically want to put it out there so that people don't have to buy both and are still able to use it for its purpose, and making sure that that happens, it gets done, and it looks gorgeous is so you, I guess. Like it's a very, it's consistent and consistently great to be in the next project, and all of the things that we loved most about the first one, especially in behind the scenes, is just consistently still coming through. So it's really wonderful to see.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting place and something I hadn't necessarily thought about, but I had this real commitment to making things better and continually improving and doing things pretty iteratively. So maybe now's a good time, Ryan, to show. I have like a weekly scroll announcement. Not really, but so one of the things that will be happening too, I'm trying to keep changes minimal to the original material, but there's some artwork updates that I wanted to share. And so I don't know, Hunter, if you can see that. So I do listen to your show. And one of the things, the feedback that I got that I agreed with was, there was a lot in there, but was around the resting piece of artwork that seemed to not fit. And so this is sort of the updated rest artwork that folks will see in the reprint. And anyone who got the digital files, they'll get this automatically updated. But the idea was to kind of go back with that extra layer of polish. The other piece, we can talk more about it if it's helpful, but trying to come up with a little bit more of a cohesive style with the maps in particular. So there's an example of the text map. I still like the maps from the first game. I still think they work really well. There were some like printing challenges in terms of the export files and how much I could sort of sharpen images and text and things that probably no one's very interested in. I don't know. But the other piece was I got some feedback around the usability of the maps and the overall sort of vibe that didn't work for some people. So that was the other idea of trying to bring them into a more sort of Cloud Empress vision. And so that's part of that. The books have been out since November, December for probably most backers, retailers in January, February. But I've had probably 6 months to kind of think about how everything went and really sort of assess, you know, is there anything I'd like to change? And there's a couple things that I'm making some modifications of. And one of those, yeah, I just thought it. So this is the sort of two travelers, one of them a body hopper, a disgusting corpse, sitting and you know, wading their feet in the fish with the fish and kind of having a relaxing moment in nature.
This is a great piece. I love this piece.
It's gorgeous. I want to actually take the individual art piece and blow it up for people watching. Which one's this one? There we go. Unlock you. This is fantastic. And having a body hopper, because I mean, you know, surprising no one and liking creepy shit. I really love the body hopper and everything that it is. So having a nice big piece of that is really fantastic. And I love that, like, even though this person is like a creepy corpse person, they're just like chilling, hanging out with this other guy.
So very relaxing piece. Definitely very much fits the rest page.
Yeah. I don't so outside of the maps and the change to the art and stuff, are there any other big changes to the core books, or are they mostly like tweaks and whatnot?
I would I think the rule book I'm going with kind of a 1.1. So the other thing is I'm co-locating the lore. So moving a lot of the lore to the middle of the book, the original idea was spreading it out so that it would make for a more interesting reading experience. But I think, for instance, which maybe someone has mentioned here in this room, or virtual room, having like two page spread on the Imago and then another spread on the Imago, like 20 pages apart, doesn't really make sense. The idea with that was to like co-locate some of the rules. So the lore is kind of being combined together. And then the other, I would say, big change, and as a business, a lot has changed since the first campaign went live. The context that I think is helpful for folks, sort of see me now and where I'm at and have questions and feedback on some of the decisions I'm making, not a ton, but you know, in terms of like, why didn't I just do hardcover in the previous campaign?
Everyone's a critic, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's a good, you know, I think some people do have that as a stretch goal, right? Going from zine to hardcover. My previous campaign was like $1,500, and then the second campaign did 98,000. And so I still wanted to, like I said, to kind of keep with that original vision of the product. And I had all these mock-ups and stuff. So I just wasn't prepared for that level of funding. And maybe if I expected it again, I would do things differently. But the other piece, like, as we talked about in maybe a previous podcast, was that a lot of the first project was sort of about page constraints in particular. And so the Last Voyage of the Bean Barge introductory adventure was always intended to go with the rule book. And that was something that it just would not fit. 60 pages was sort of the limit with our printer, including the covers. And so I had to cut it out as a separate zine. What I ended up having is a bunch of like SKUs, what they're called. And so they're individual products that can be bundled or and sold together or sold separately, those kinds of things. But it, when you're doing the fulfillment yourself, it doesn't really matter. I mean, it's time intensive, but I was just putting, you know, putting 10 to 12 items together, whatever. But then when you work with a fulfillment partner, at times putting that stuff together, like each time they touch a product is like 40 cents. And so all of a sudden, like packing six postcards, you need barcodes on those postcards, or otherwise you have to pay another 40 cents. And then, so, you know, it gets really expensive. And so part of the idea with the sort of new second Kickstarter is to do stuff that feels really high quality, that's really exciting, that feels like a dopamine rush when you open it up. It feels like sort of a treasure chest, but also reducing the number of SKUs. And so to that, we'll be adding the Last Voyage of the Bean Barge to the rule book in that hardcover, sort of at the back, like Frontier Scum is the one that with the, I think, at the Oregon train, yeah, is one of my favorites. So it has the intro adventure in there, and then the adventures from the like year one adventure bundle, or the five, you know, or, you know, adventure pieces, those are going to get split up into different setting books based on where they're located and some other factors.
Cool. I maintain that like that was a good decision for the first project. Like, I appreciate, first off, I also love having a lot of little zines that I just put in my backpack and I take to my like game table, you know, like I always appreciate that. But I think the accessibility to be like, I want to try Cloud Empress, the rules are online, I can buy one of these adventure zines and I can have it. And then when I want more, I can buy more. And then maybe I'll run the hex crawl when I know that my party wants to play all of it, or I can afford to buy everything. Like, I think it was a great idea. I think this, where you are now, is a great evolution of that. I think you're heading in like a great direction, and it doesn't feel like, it feels incredibly like an genuine, like iterative process, but I still love the original, like just bundle of zines.
Yeah. And I like, I mean, there's a usability factor too. pulling an adventure out and just having it be a single adventure, right? And not having to flip through a big book and just sort of having it there. So I still, it's just interesting. There's the art we receive is always funneled through this layer of commerce. And so,
you put it like that's really horrifying, but yeah.
I mean, and if it's not, the production quality usually reflects that, right? So it's still a commercial decision, unless that person has just like a bunch of talents. But even then, they've probably trained in some kind of commercial setting or, you know, whatever. I mean, so unless there's some folk artist that's, you know, painting on barns, but even that becomes part of the commercial story. So it's finding a place in that and accepting what you're making as a product and what you're making relates to the business decisions of your time period. It's sort of interesting to be in it, but then also trying to put that through the lens of what's best for your audience and what's best for you and what all these kinds of things. It's a lot to weigh in the like goal of making a product line, for example. or just any product, any kind of art.
Yeah, I. So about the book and the zines and stuff, I definitely wore about whether I like a big old hardback book or a bunch of little pieces, because like as a collector, I love one giant beautiful hardback book. As a GM, all the little zines and stuff like that, to me, is such the better decision for usability. The fact that I could have like the rule book flat in front of me and have the adventure flat in front of me right here and not have to like try to parse and flip and do all this stuff with this giant book. So I'm glad that I'm gonna have both now. That's wonderful for me.
And the hardcovers are all going to be around 70 pages, so that's pretty small for a hardcover. So I still like the having a lot of stuff. I mean, that feels to me sort of central to the stuff I like. And I also, one of my joys is reading a most books. Like, I love reading a book in like 2 to 3 sittings. Like, that's sort of my ideal. I don't know if that's from my ADHD or what, but I just love reading through books pretty quickly. And I'd much rather have like 3 smaller books than one giant book. I don't know. Maybe I have a lot of guilt or shame, or I don't know what, but I get like halfway through and I'm like, gosh, I have a lot more to go.
I think you're in a safe space with that one here, friend.
I think so.
The two people you're talking to are also like, oh yeah, there's too many words, too many times in a row. And I'm like, oh God.
Yeah, no, it's really hard. It's hard to, and that's the thing that we run into a lot here on the show. And me and Hunter always have this constant debate, and I think we switch sides a lot and then realize that we switched and went back on usability of books, layout of books, like reading it as an experience versus reading it as a guide, and like where the line is on that. And my thought, like, I just want a rationale a lot of times that I feel is missing. And I also think that there's this, I can't remember what it's called, but I think there might have been like a mini discourse on it recently about like being so in your thing that you forget that other people don't know all the stuff that you know. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we see a lot. So it's just an interesting, like, there's no answer. It's just like how it feels right and stuff like that. It's nice to know, again, though, that like that's a thought process that you have at the books, and like the reason that it was one way the first time, the reason it's changing a little bit this time. And like you said, having it be an iterative process as opposed to being like, nope, I did it the right way. You know, you guys can just deal with it. No, it's like I'm listening, I'm hearing, you know, I'm getting the feedback, and I'm trying to do what's best for everybody. So again, like it's, you know, it's one of the things we love about you. So like I said, the rationale is really important, and it's nice to hear that every time you come on.
So moving on to like life and death. So tell us, what is this new adventure for Cloud Empress / setting?
Yeah, it's the sort of centerpiece to the campaign, at least in my mind, is around these 2 new setting books. Each one is going to be about the size of Land of Cicadas, give or take. So slightly larger, because Land of Cicadas is going to grow slightly. So each one's going to be around like 72 pages, somewhere in there. And what I tried to do with Land of Cicadas, the first setting book, was really include a little bit of everything. So it is, tries to be sort of the quintessential setting book, because it's going to be paired with the rule book in the starter box. It sort of highlights the humor and the weirdness, and also some of the horror elements that are sort of on the edge of the game. The Rust Bucket in particular, folks have read it. There's this sort of dilapidated city that's full of some like really grotesque, horrifying stuff sort of on the corners there. That's not sort of central to Cloud Empress's identity, but it's sort of a big part of it as well. So with Life and Death, it's in the extremes, and they're paired together. They sort of also highlight this contrast that I try to do with the games and the world. So Land of the Living, which I'm co-authoring with an author named M. Mattson, focuses on this vibrant, overgrown, overflowing with fungal and spores garden area, as well as this lake that's torn by slipstreams. So time and space, and it's just like really vibrant and growing and chaotic, and there's a lot of people there. We tried to focus in on what sort of more specifically indigenous cultures of the Midwest in the far, far future might be like and what kind of communities they would form. And then the other book is sort of the total opposite in that it's the landscape underneath one of the cloud cities that's cratered and fallen and decimated the entire landscape. And so it's this desert of ash, and that draws on the first Land of the Living book draws on, I think, a lot more explicitly Nausicaa in particular, some of the ways, and the Nausicaa manga too. There's some there's like a tribe of folks that live in the fungal forest in the poison forest that we don't see necessarily in the movie. With Land of the Dead, it's like Bloodborne, really dark stuff, some Fallout kind of stuff. So it is a recent apocalyptic event that has happened in the world. The setting itself, Cloud Empress, takes place in this far, far future that looks really different and is sort of in the ruins of another civilization. But I've never really meant it to feel necessarily like apocalyptic. It's always meant to be just people living in a time period in a new way. Whereas this one, Land of the Dead book, is really meant to explore the trauma, like how trauma is personified in land and in people and in memory. So it's going to be pretty dark. One of the other neat things about both books that I think I've shared, but these both take place 2 to 3 months after the events of Land of Cicadas. And one of the things that I think is, I don't know, I don't see a ton in TTRPG setting books. You all might point to many more, but it's the book takes place in a specific summer over a 3 month period. And so it's the summer of the Century Brood. So this is sort of the late summer, early fall. And so it actually moves forward in time slightly. And so you don't need to play them in a particular order. And I think most wardens or GMs could easily navigate, or ignore that time change with their players. But for instance, a Spikehead, one of the weird like hybrid human fungal creatures that we saw in Land of the Cicadas, is back in a new way, in a new place in Land of the Living. Whereas Prince Bug, who we saw in this horrible battlefield within Land of Cicadas, is now in a tower in Land of the Dead in a new setting in a new way. And so folks get to learn more about those characters and what happened. Obviously, again, like there's not a definitive story that was told in either of those books. So, wardens may have to get a little creative with how that all connects. But the other component to the setting is this idea that time and space are slippery and that memories change things, and there's some ambiguity in terms of how reality works too. So I think it's just as easy that these are different versions of them, or versions from another time, or you could just change their names entirely. I don't know. So I think there's a lot of opportunities there. But for folks that played and read the first books, there will be some continuity between some of the characters you see, as well as probably most importantly on the covers of both of the books, the Cloud Empress we see again, and the Cloud Empress is making her way through the world. And so the traveling party is still sort of following in her footsteps and seeing what she's up to through these two books.
That's so cool. I can't tell you how much I'm stoked for it being like you said, obviously not force sequential, but I would absolutely run this as like, it's the summer, you all meet and get together, and then after the summer, you have this fall. That's amazing. I love the fact that you bring back your characters like later on. And I also agree, like, I think the way you set this up is like, yeah, the slip makes things weird. Like, it could not technically be non-linear. Or some interpretation that gives a lot of freedom to the wardens to run it how they would. I'm going to run it sequentially because I'm a big nerd like that. So along with these two, the Land of the Living, Land of the Dead, what else is being added? Is there anything else that's being added that you think is substantial you'd like to talk about
Well,
along with
the
these?
other piece too is, for folks that aren't aware, Cloud Empress is a hex crawl, so it has a big hex map, and that's how folks primarily explore the world, as well as these adventure locations that you could run as one or two shot adventures and some introductory adventures. The neat thing is that the books will come with a giant map. I mean, it'll be, I don't know how big it'll be, probably 11 by 17, so it won't be much bigger in terms of actual product that folks got in the first campaign, but it'll have all of these things connected in a single landscape. And so Land of Cicadas will sort of be down here. The Land of the Living will be up top. And then the Land of the Dead will be east of the Land of Cicadas, west of the Land of Cicadas. So it'll be this sort of larger landscape and effectively triple the size of the setting, at least through hexes that we saw in the Land of Cicadas. And those same hexes will be present on this map in a new format.
Cool. I love that. I love the big development hex map of this world. Yeah. See, it's your grand hex crawl.
So as part of the story, and you said it's advancing a little bit. Is your thought to every time something comes out to slowly advance a story, or is that just for this one?
Yeah, there are a lot more books planned. I think it's meant to be a three-part sort of trilogy, at least as I've imagined it at this point. And so the first part of the trilogy is sort of ended with these two books, with this four-book box. The next part of the trilogy is going to take place in the clouds above where we're at. And so I think the idea is, yes, it'll take place with a more significant time jump forward. I think, I'm so excited about that stuff, and I try not to, I want people to be excited about the current stuff. But I think the general concept with that is the marriage and selection of a new Cloud Empress would be sort of one of the big key events that's happening in sort of the second part of the trilogy.
That would make sense, because we all know that Cloud abandoned their forced duties.
Listen,
in fact, we actually went on an adventure with Cloud on this channel.
Listen, the Farmerlings stole Cloud, and that is clearly why we had to send the expedition down there so we could take what's rightfully ours. Yeah. Speaking of the 29th expedition, that's still happening, right? Is death a lot of like the fallout from that, like in this book, or is there going to be a point where that's ever a part of the Cloud Empress storyline you want to focus on, or is it mostly going to be kind of like the traumas of war, not actually looking at it directly?
So the Land of the Cicadas was sort of a bigger attempt. There is like sort of a battlefield and a war setting in the central part, and so that was sort of the most direct look, although we will see sort of Cloudling forces in these other areas sort of, but they're more stragglers, and this is meant to be sort of a difficult journey to get into these areas. And so in the case of the Land of the Dead, it's a giant desert, it's horrible, there's not a lot to live, it's polluted with chalk. There's actually I'll talk a little bit about, I forget the name of it, maybe it doesn't have a name at this point, but there is sort of a wall, like sort of area, like there's a Cloudling settlement with a lordling that's been tasked with keeping everyone in this area inside of it, except for scraplings that can bring goods out. So they're still not allowed to leave necessarily, but it's sort of this giant crater and there's a fort on it. And so we see a lordling that's sort of been long-term tasked with sort of keeping the secrets and the wreckage of this area within these confines. We also see the survivors of a Cloudling security force that lived in, it's called Bravo City, that collapsed and fell. Yeah. And so they're the only real remaining survivors, because they dipped out and hid in the center of the city in this sort of armored area and survived the crash, much to the dismay of the residents there. And so the residents hunt them as ghosts while they raid as bandits any kind of travelers or relic hunters or folks that are in the area. And so we see more of Cloudland culture, but it's a place that most people do not want to go to, except for this these strange dreams and this mysterious voice that calls to master magicians. And so magicians across the lowland wastes and even in the clouds are being called to this underground area of the city for unknown reasons. And so that's sort of a catalyst, and again, some lordlings and folks of import from Cloudling society will be headed that way, but the Cloudling 29th expedition has no value in this area. With the Land of the Living, it is pretty far past the Thickwood, which is incredibly dangerous, and so most Cloudlings just aren't skillful enough to make it that far north because of how dangerous it is. So we still get to see touches of Cloud Link Society, but it is difficult for Cloud Links to make it this far, at least the 29th expedition, which has this sort of pomp and egotism that sort of prevents them from being particularly effective. I would say two, the 29th expedition is not successful, as you kind of see in Land of Cicadas. So by the fall, they're starting to really reconsider what's going on and starting to probably retreat into the clouds that we'll see again in kind of future setting books.
It's so funny because at no point in time did I ever assume, knowing what I know about the setting, that it would be successful.
Well, it's too, I mean, you have to have some, it's sort of this like George Bush mission accomplished thing. It's like, well, what would be success look like, right? I mean, conquering and keeping a land that doesn't want you, that you don't have authority over. That's not all meant to be an Iraq analogy. I'd have to think about that through that lens. But at least for the Cloudlings, as I think about them, part of it is their goals are elusive and foolish, and their dreams are a big part of the setting. And so it's this sort of magical dream thinking to conquer this land, and these aspirations from societies long past that don't really matter or aren't effective in the society that they live in.
Yeah, I never really thought that they like planned to win it. It's a 29th one for a reason.
Strategy?
It's not that there's no exit strategy. I always read it as more of like an incursion to like spend money, maybe get rid of some political rivals, go for like a foray, and then just like go back, and then eventually like when enough drama has risen, we can go again. It's the 29th one. Like they're not.
Yeah.
Like that's how I always felt. It was more like we're going to go down there, we're going to fuck around for a little bit, then we're going to come home. I never thought it is like go down there and like we are going to rule everything, you know, again or whatever. That's how I always kind of viewed it more than anything. I don't know. I always saw it as more of like a rich people like on the side, you know, watching the Civil War kind of thing versus like, you know, actually thinking that they were going to go down there and conquer everything. But, you know, I mean, that was just my impression of.
Well, and I think it's like any war, it's players all have their own agendas. And so we see many individual lordlings and cloudlings going down there just to obtain a crest and a title so that they can personally advance. We see Papan the Crestless, who has these either greater mission or greater message from the emperor themselves or himself to figure out a way to go to space. And so this is some sort of plan to bring humanity back to space. And then we have one particular lordling. I think it's Renal the Sleepy, who is a body hopper and just sort of seems to forget the past. And so I think for him, it's more of a glorious charge and the fulfillment of previous dreams that he can't remember anymore or specifically doesn't write down his failures in this book of his history. So he's never sort of capturing any of his failures in his memory, because when body hoppers hop from one corpse to another, they lose quite a bit of their memory. And much to his, I think, nephew's chagrin, I'm forgetting some of the details, but much to his nephew's chagrin, who's his sort of boy ward, he's never tasked with writing down any of his failures or bad ideas. And so leading this just horrible charge into...
Are you sure this isn't like an American satire? Because this sounds a lot like American written history. So,
hey, listen, like they said, mission accomplished. So we did it. We won. Let's go home now to do it again later. Another part of this project is the stretch goals. We're coming up on another one we'll talk about in a second, but two of the things that I thought were really interesting are the Empress's Almanac, the Cloud Empress Almanac, and the solo rules, the Arrivals and Routines. So what exactly is the Empress's Almanac? And then tell me about the solo pamphlet.
So the 2024 Cloud Empress Almanac is probably something I'm most proud of. I've been doing an expansion a month for the last like 9 to 10 months, I want to say. I'm not exactly sure how long. And those have slowly gotten nicer and nicer, at least in my opinion, in that they most of them have unique artwork. All of them have artwork, at least at this point, and they come out as a spread that folks can get as a PDF download from my Google Drive. But the idea with this was to start to create content on a monthly basis for a couple of reasons. One, I think it reminds people the game exists. It gives them new things. My audience also, like, or you, I mean, if you subscribe, you get to vote on what I write in many cases. And so, or at least the order in which I write it at other times. So it's this other way to be in conversation with community. And I've already seen some folks suggesting stuff that I'm like, oh, like somebody asked about festivals. So I think that's like going to be a great newsletter expansion, just a spread of festivals with some cool festival art. So the idea is to keep Cloud Empress vibrant throughout the time that it exists, not only in these Kickstarter projects, but also sort of design stuff that's stretch goals that are exciting to get, but not a ton of work to make, at least in the development. So we have them mostly done now. They still need to be professionally edited and packaged, but I think that stretch goals are extremely dangerous. Success is more dangerous to Kickstarter and crowdfunding creators, I think, than failure is. And so how do I make stretch goals that are achievable and doable? The other piece that I think a lot about is how do I build a business that supports me in a way that keeps me healthy and sane and all these kinds of things, but also how do I build something that is accessible to folks of a variety of level of incomes? And so I think the other piece with this is doing stretch goals that feel really nice and beautiful in your hands that are print, but having really accessible digital content. And so something like this, Funeral for the Anti-Saint, which is a new adventure, is free. I try to give a lot of stuff out for free online, and that's part of this. You know, this could all be a Patreon, and it could be like, oh, you got to pay a certain, and I'm not knocking Patreon or people that do that, but that's my business model is giving away a lot for free in hopes that it will be appreciated, and then that appreciation will turn into financial support around a few key product releases, you know, a year, like one or two. So that's the almanac. And folks can look at the newsletter for most of the stuff that's going to be in there. There's going to be like a little intro and some, maybe some extra little goodies. The other one though is Cloud Empress. I've always sort of intended to be very solo friendly. And so that even comes down to like the number of hexes I put and how I arrange the map so that you can roll to find a random hex, for example. It's sort of designed that way. I'm really happy with the solo rolls. They're really weird. And I don't think a lot of solo games simulate a single person, and you're sort of the heroic adventurer that's traveling the world. With the Cloud Empress solo rolls, you're simulating an entire traveling party. And my biggest inspiration was The Sims. And so you're sort of generating these personas for each of your traveling party members, including like how they react to disagreement. And that can set off violent encounters sort of on their own if they have the wrong responses, but also when and why they would leave the traveling party. And so you have this sort of rolling cast of characters that moves through the world to achieve different goals. And so Rivals and Routines, I wanted to continue to support the solo play with some like sort of new features again that weren't going to be, I'd like to do a larger like compilation of solo with expanded content and artwork and those kinds of things at some point, but sort of building it out piece by piece based on what people are using and needing. But its two functions are, one, there's not really a way to automate when the party rests and when they explore and when they move through the world. Right now, I think that's mostly like a player decision. And I don't know how much solo playing you do. When I play solo games, I immediately go for like tropes. like I immediately start telling this heroic story or this really trope-laden story. And so I really like solo play that's systematized and random because it makes stories that are unexpected. And I find that really enjoyable versus when I start to write my own solo stories or whatever, experience them, oftentimes I just fall in like trope after trope after trope, and it feels like a very familiar story. And I just don't like that. And probably other people are more creative and subversive in their own minds. But I think when you're playing a game with yourself, having a lot of unexpected outcomes and things that, for me, what I enjoy about solo is figuring out the puzzle of like why someone did this in character. Like, okay, I know they're going to be really angry. Why did they get really angry? I know they're going to rest and it's going to be a little unexpected. Like, why did they choose to do that? And then that's sort of, for me, at least with Cloud Empress, where the role playing happens. And so that's one part. The other piece is that's the routines. The Rivals piece is, I got this from Into the Odd has sort of this rival setup that I thought was really neat. And so it's how to generate a rival traveling party, and including motivations and sort of weirdness and what they're carrying and who's following them. And so it's this idea of having another version of you. There's a lot of travelers out in the world because the society and the lowland wastes is migratory, especially in the summer. And so who else is traveling and why are they in conflict with you? And sometimes that conflict could be like, you're both looking for the same thing, or they're an ex-lover that's kind of mad at you. And like, they're, you know, they're just like, I don't know. I don't want to make it too dark or anything, but you know, they're like, you don't like them anymore. And so you're bumping into them in all these social engagements. So it doesn't necessarily mean, again, with the whole vibe of Cloud Empress, that it's this person waiting in the bushes trying to shoot you. I think that might be the case, you know, once in a while, but I think the traveling rival parties are going to be for a variety of motivations and reasons, and also designing at least that piece to be something that would be potentially interesting and useful to folks playing in a multiplayer setting as well. And that'll be a trifold template.
I love Cloud Empress. I love so much about Cloud Empress, but I do really appreciate the fact that, I mean, obviously you created it and you have an amazing understanding of the thing that you've created, but like that whole, like your group of friends or like new acquaintances, like traveling through the summer together. I love that you're, like, solo rules are going to keep that focus because, yeah, I don't think like the single hero narrative would work well. And I love that the interplay of people and, like, yeah, figuring out what they're, why they do the things that they do. And the rival system sounds like a blast. I could see that being just a person who doesn't attack you, but just kind of subverts you and tries to fuck you over every time they bump into you, or is just kind of rude.
Or like a wanderling ghost that just like is pissed at you and just seems to materialize like, you know, like, hey, like, why'd you do that? Like, why'd you kill me? You know, something like the humor is something I always try to keep like sort of on that, you know, another kind of element on the edge. I think it's really dangerous to center humor at the center of things for me.
Yeah.
People's sense of humor is just, it's all over, and I don't know.
Want to force it. You want it to be like a natural occurrence.
And I try to give people, like, one of the biomes is called Thickwood, you know, so it's just sort of on the cusp there. Like, if people want to mess with that, they can, like, if, you know, or Fort Snick, like, that's a little bit more on it. But, you know, it's like, do you want to touch it or not? I don't know. You know, is that something your group's interested in? You know, I try not to can jokes for people, but yeah.
No. Thickwood would be the whole episode of stuff over on Dragonbane. So absolutely. I think in our Dragonbane campaign, there's a, I don't even know what it's called. It's called like the Magnus Woods or something. And there's not been a single time I haven't called it like Magnum Wood. So Thickwood would definitely get the triple C treatment on that one. That's a lot of stuff you're packing into a trifold pamphlet, though. Like, it sounds like I thought like you could fill a whole book with everything you were just talking about. So for just a trifold, that's going to be pretty dense as well, right?
Yeah, I guess the for me, solo has to be really rules light.
Right.
I guess I don't know why, but that's, to me, it has to be. I guess it's, why is that? I don't know. It's social obligation goes a long way for me in playing a game with other people. like doing the work. I do play a lot of solo board games now, but to take the time to set something up and also learn it, and it's not a social experience, I think it's a little challenging for me. And so I think the Rivals piece is going to be like the entire interior spread of the pamphlet, and then there will be a cover, and then I think the back will be the routine for traveling. So I think that's sort of how to imagine it, with some like little text blurbs explaining what they kind of do and how to use them.
Gotcha.
I also don't want my solo play to be that like heavily ruled.
I completely agree. Yeah, like you said, if there's other people I'm doing stuff with, the amount of time it takes to get set up and prepped and ready to go feels good. But if it's just me, man, like I don't want it to be that. I don't want an hour set up to play with myself, you know? One of the things you said about Cloud Empress, in the specifically about gosh, something we said just a bit ago, the almanac and everything, is really interesting. I know that Cairn 2E is funding right now. And its campaign blew up as well. And that book has been free digitally forever, which is super appreciative. Like, it's great for people to play it. And even if you look at like WotC's business model with 5e, they make all these adventures and all this bullshit or whatever, but their number one seller every year perpetually is always a core rule book, and everything they do is designed to just sell more core rule books. So I think it's really I think it's really intelligent. I wish more people would stop paywalling like their core stuff, because getting the access to the game, every time you write a new adventure, someone's gonna be like, oh, that looks neat. Oh, I need the rules to play, so I'll go get the rules. But like Mouse Shredder, for example, is another one where like all of their core stuff is free. But let me tell you what, those box sets fly off the shelves. So it's just really intelligent, for at least from my perspective, with the number of games and stuff that we've reviewed and read, and the accessibility aspect of it. Like, value is a score on our metrics for a reason. And having free rules and stuff is such a huge part of it, but also is the extra content. So when you can have, like right now, you can find the core rules, you can find an adventure, you can find all that stuff. And if someone didn't back the first one when they're looking at life and death and stuff like that, like if I wouldn't back the first one, I can tell you right now, as soon as I saw death, I would have bought this one too. But to check it out, I can go get the rules now. So to me, I think that's a fantastic model to always have as much digitally free, especially in this environment financially that so many people live in. But just in general, like, you're gonna push a lot more people towards your game when your game is accessible, and then everything you put out can continue to feed back to the beginning. So I really, again, another reason we really like the way that you're doing stuff. So we'll just say that a bunch more times.
We're big fans. I don't know if you've caught on to this. We're like huge fans of yours, so
only
well, I
our
think too.
fifth only our fifth episode, you know.
I mean, I buy vinyl, right? So it's like, I can get the vinyl on Spotify, but it's the experience. And so I try to think about that as like the experience of touching something physically is really magical. And reading for me, I mean, reading, I still read a lot in print, and so that's kind of the target, like, point of sale that I'm thinking about is, and also too, I mean, I think it's just, gosh, I don't know how giving value sounds. Like, creating value for people sounds
Bringing
bad,
value for the shareholders, you
but
know?
I would say being generous is probably the more human way to say that. Of like, I think generosity goes both ways, and so I think if someone is, I'll give an example. I think Cool Mini or not, I don't know. I play a lot of board games, but they do these really. They're one of the big like Kickstarter breakout companies, right? They do these campaigns with like a ton of stretch goals, that are all like miniatures, and you get like double the amount of miniatures if you back the stretch goals and stuff. But there's a lot of like FOMO that's used to, like, you only have this one chance to get it, and then it's going to be like $200 more. And obviously some of that's dictated by their manufacturing costs and the tooling charges and all these kinds of things. But I think a lot of times the way that they generate FOMO is not very generous to their audience. And I think that's reflected then in like how their audience treats them and how they talk about the company. And there's not a lot of generosity when you hear people talk about Cool Mini or not, for example. And so I think that's the piece too, that I want to build a community that feels generous to one another and to me for my own. I mean, I can't control that part, but you know, offering the discount that I think I could viably do and still remain soluble and healthy and happy for the folks that, you know, supporting people that support you early on is really important to me, and making sure like the folks that backed Hot Stuff on Shore Leave, like they took the biggest risk on me, and the people that backed the previous campaign took a bigger risk, you know, or whatever, same amount of risk or whatever. But, you know, really supporting the people that support you is important, provided, you know, they're not, you know, toxic or really holding you to standards that are unreasonable or something like that. And that's too, where I think that's the other piece about being really loose with like a refund policy and just like, hey, like, no, this is like, this isn't working. I haven't had to do that. I don't think really ever, but I'm really open to people not buying my stuff. Like if, you know, whatever, like if it's not for you or you think it's a bad move, what I'm doing, like, I can tell you why, like, we could talk through it. I can show you some of the rationale, but I'm happy to fire customers too. Like, I don't know. That's
it is a fine line, you know. I mean, it's good to err on the side of like of generosity, of creating a positive space, but it's also good to keep in mind that, like, yeah, absolutely, fire a customer. You know, if that person's in the comments of your Kickstarter page saying that because they've given you money, they also own part of your project and you'll answer to them, you should get rid of that person.
I haven't had to do that yet, so it's easy for me to say, right? Like, but I'm
definitely like referencing a specific instance that
yeah. But I mean, also, you might not have had to deal with that because of the way that you've promoted and been like, it's exactly the community that you've built, you know, like you yeah. would, I mean, with the amount of money across both projects and the number of backers that you're bringing into both, like, it's great that you're thousands of people at this point and haven't had to deal with that. And that could also be part of that generosity too. Speaking of generosity as well, gosh, this number's gone up since I've been sitting here watching it. But you're about, I don't know, $490 away from the next stretch goal. And that stretch goal is, if I remember correctly, let me stretch out so I'm not talking on my ass.
But it's the Creator Fund.
The Creator Fund. Speaking of generosity, I know that you've previously, you know, there's a part on your website about like grants and stuff, but what is the Clyde Empress Creator Fund? And what made you want to have that as a stretch goal here in this project?
So totally stole this from Possum Creek Games. Wander Home did this. It was such a great idea, so I'm happy to do it. I haven't seen a ton of people do this. So I hope more folks see my campaign and see Possum Creek's game and with Wander Home. I guess what it is, it's through the Kickstarter. It's not a charity. It is a, I'm commissioning someone to make something for the world of Clad Empress through an open application process. And so I think they are going to be like $500 grants. And that's really to do pretty much whatever you want with it. You have to sort of talk about how you're going to use that funds, but that could be, I know artwork's expensive, right? So I want to spend all $500 on a cover of a whatever. Or it could be, I need to pay some of my bills so that I can not have to do gig work, or so that I can feel more comfortable and have the mental space to do this writing. There's no expectation of completing it. It would be really great. I announce who those people are and what they're doing. So I think the audience creates that expectation, but, you know, obviously stuff comes up. It's just sort of it's meant to be a grant in that someone has a good idea. The other piece too, that isn't, it's sort of central, is this idea of trying to get the money in the hands of people that are newer or wouldn't necessarily, you know, see themselves reflected in the TTRPG industry and really hear from unique voices. And so that's the other kind of piece around it, is looking at one of the things I've always tried to do with Clad Empress is to have a really diverse team working on it, diversity in sort of all aspects that I can think of. So this is another opportunity to continue to grow that diverse team that contributes to Clad Empress. And then the other piece too, I mean, that's sort of first. The second piece of that is sort of supporting this Clad Empress ecosystem. So Clad Empress has a really, I was going to say generous, it's sort of standard in the third party world, but people can make stuff with Clad Empress, and they have the badge, you know, set in the world of Cloud Empress, so people can make content using a lot of the like overarching themes and setting and lore and mechanisms. So it's just sort of supporting that sort of creation as well. And it's really fun to hear people's ideas and to encourage the work. It's been a good time. And the other piece, one of the things I was really surprised by, I did some amount of surveying previous backers about why did you back the project? Like what are you interested in? And part of the thing too is I'm really motivated to be community driven and as ethical as I can be, and really try to be a values driven publisher. And so part of that was engaging my audience and hearing what they wanted to support. So how did they prioritize recycled paper versus funding indie creators and that kind of thing? And by and large, the biggest thing that they told me was like, we want to support you as a small creator doing this, and we want to support other people who are indie creators making artwork. And I think that can be like surprising and humbling for me. But it's really awesome to be part of a community by and large, like the TTRPG world, that supports so many indie creators and supports them in taking these risks, but also wants to like further that chain of support through folks, you know, even smaller than myself, making new stuff for Cloud Empress.
I do love how supportive the indie scene is. It really is always, yeah, humbling and just astounding how much everyone tries to prop each other up on their shoulders to like get the everyone seen more and get the work out and like the promotion that we all do for each other at all points in time. It really is very lovely, you know, especially when you're on Twitter and you're like, well, at least something's good on Twitter, you know?
Well, I'll say too, just for me, I've told this story maybe a couple times. I don't think I've told it here. I hope not. I repeat
tell it again.
was making the first Cloud Empress book. I was selling a lot of my stuff to buy the artwork. And so I sold a Rickenbacker bass guitar that I had for a long time to get, you know, I think it was like $900 to buy more art. And I was running out of money. And there was a game jam that Sean McCoy of Tuesday Night Games sort of kicked up, you know, or supported on the Discord. I think somebody else maybe came up with it, but it was this idea called Voices of the Void, where folks would create mothership pamphlets and materials that sort of existed in world, like diegetic pamphlets and materials. And his sort of commitment was like, we'll buy 50 copies of what everyone makes, like whatever they are, just we'll buy them and we'll put them on the store and it'll be this fun thing. And so I don't know how I calculated it exactly, but I was like, oh my gosh, like that's $250 if I sell it at this much. And, you know, that's like two pieces of artwork that I'm not, you know, that could help the Kickstarter campaign. So I spent probably like, I don't know, like probably 20 to 30 hours on this. It was called Anaforms, and I should release it for free still. Yeah. But it's essentially about this machine that lets you put your brain into the brain of an animal for a short amount of time. And so it's about androids starting to do this, where androids are starting to upload their consciousness into like pigeons and bunnies and stuff. And there's a celebrity that her brain's put into a tiger and the tiger's abducted. And, you know, there's this mystery thing. But yeah, anyway, I did this whole thing for like $250, right? So, you know, money is so subjective in terms of what. But for me, like a $500 would have been like so much freaking money to pursue my art. Like, wow. Like, you know, so, but now looking at a campaign that's like close to $75,000, like $200 isn't, you know, or $500 isn't that much to give to somebody else to do that work. And I don't know how that makes me sound, but it's just strange, like a little success, if you can maintain it. And again, like, keep your reputation intact and keep your wellness intact, like your personal health and wellness intact. Success feels like it can really steamroll if you build that goodwill and you start to build an audience that is interested in your work. You know, a lot of it is still difficult, but a lot of it becomes a lot easier, and a lot less stressful when people start to get to know you a little bit and they start to like what you make.
I think it's great that like your takeaway from like coming from the point of selling your Rickenbacker bass guitar and like doing this 30 hours of work for 250 extra bucks, your takeaway from that is that now you're on the flip side, you're like, oh no, I will give somebody the opportunity to not have to sell that thing that they have that they like, even if it's a thing that maybe they don't use every day, but they like, or to put in like a ton of extra work for not a little bit. I mean, right now for me, 250 bucks would be great, but like I think it says a lot about you as a person, your character, that that's your takeaway from it.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, and I just, two people that are in my special thanks are, Sean McCoy and Luke Gehring. Sean, because the TKG web store like buys a bunch of stuff and they don't, I think that's the same with Exalted Funeral. I did my first zine and Exalted Funeral and Spearwitch bought like 20 of them. And I was like, 20, you know, like, oh my gosh, you know, and even, Exalted Funeral, I forget who it was working there. I don't remember their name. But they were like, oh, do you need like help paying for the print run? Like, you know, we'll pay, we'll help you, you know, we can front you the money and then you can send it to us and all this kinds of stuff. And that's just like so cool. I think there are a lot of the vendors aren't like tastemakers in the way that they let their audience be the tastemaker. They do sort of take reasonable risks, right? Based on how something looks. And you know, I don't think I don't know, like my book Werewolves of Wall Street, like no one was gonna buy 200 copies right away, right? Because I was an unknown entity and the book didn't look as good as Cloud Empress. But just the willingness to take risks, and I think too, cultures have values, right? Like communities have values, and there's a value about like experimentation and newness and strangeness that is so, I think, built into the zine format in particular, and why I love zines so much. It doesn't really, you know, that's the other piece too, is this sort of like, I don't know, going through like publisher puberty is like, it doesn't make a lot of sense for me to publish zines as much anymore with the like financial level I'm at. But it's like kind of sad because zines are so awesome and so experimental and amazing. So I don't know. Yeah, that's a lot there. But I just love this community so much, and the connection between creators and publishers and all this kinds of stuff. Or I guess retailers maybe is a better way to put that, for Exalted Funeral and Spearwitch and some other folks, Igloo Tree, who does fulfillment for, you know, has done fulfillment for a lot of my campaigns.
Yeah, there's a lot of great people, great stuff in the space. I mean, Space Penguin's another one that's doing a lot of really good stuff in the community as well. So, I
Shout out,
mean,
Jert.
I think it's also really nice that you got in with Mothership, which you know, because of Sean McCoy and stuff like that, they built up a really fantastic supportive community. So it's, you know, that was a good one, I think, to get the foot in the door for and to kind of have a base in. So, I'm sure that could only have helped.
And Ian Newsome, I'll shout out more people. But Ian Newsome of
Hull Breach.
Hull Breach fame.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll just be like, Ian, like, can you look at my pledge levels, right? Like, he helped me set my pledge levels for the first campaign. Or, you know, he does some game development work, and he looked at Funeral for the Anti-Saint and was like, these are the things that aren't working for me, and here's what should change, and these kinds of things. You know, totally for free. I would have paid him, you know, or I'd be like, don't do any more. I always tell people, like, you know, like they'll say, I'll take a look at this. I'm like, please don't do anything that, you know, you'd want to charge for, or just, you know, whatever. I try not to ever use people's like time for free, at this point in my, you know, publishing career. But, you know, just like the generosity and willingness to help others, that I don't, it doesn't feel very competitive in the field. I mean, there's some friendly rivalries that I have that I look at other people's work. I heard Brian Eno on I think it was like Broken Record or something, and he has this attitude of like, I heard this and I was like, damn, that's good. Like, I wish I had thought of that. Like, that's kind of the most competitiveness I had. I was just like trying to step up my game around, you know, seeing the people around me. But the big thing I talk to new creators about, newer creators, I'm so new, what do I know, right? But is just doing something unique that has that feels identifiable. And I think you can do that at all budget levels. It's not easy, but I think if you're creative and you can execute something that feels different, or is a you know, it's just putting two things together that other people haven't put together before. There's still space for that, I think. I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the stuff that that pops up on Kickstarter, the stuff that we look at, there's times where we're both just like, man, how has someone not done this before, you know? And every time we crack up in a new zine, it's really nice to see that the innovation is still going strong. Hey, and no matter what your funding level and how much money you have to spend on projects, don't use fucking AI. So your last project funded and then delivered really quickly, and I love that on this one you actually have the fulfillment map and everything. As far as it actually getting into our hands physically, it says March of 2025. Is that, I mean, obviously that is the goal. Is the year, what month are we in now? April, January, February, March, April. So less than a year from the campaign to actually hopefully have all of it in our hands. Is that the goal?
Yeah, I'm trying to be conservative with that. I'll probably, I don't know. We'll just see. We'll see, you know, where we are. I last one was completed, I think a lot of backers got it in November, and the campaign ended in February. So whatever that is, some people, you know, December, early January for people that didn't fill out their pledge manager, or, you know, got stuff lost in the mail. The big sort of unknown for me, I mean, it is a known unknown, is just what international shipping looks like and working with a large fulfillment partner. So even something like manufacturing took a week before, it's going to take like 3 to 6 weeks now. And international shipping freight to fulfillment hubs is going to take 6 to 8 weeks. And so building that all in. So I built a giant Gantt chart now, which I did before, but it's really important. And I'm going to be working as fast as I can. Again, with some help, trying to build some healthy work-life balance stuff in here, because this isn't my day job. And I have family.
Mind-blowing that this is not your day job.
You know? Yeah. Well, the last Kickstarter could not support someone, you know, even a $100,000 campaign could not support, I mean, most people living a reasonable life, unfortunately, you know. Yeah. So
I just mean that you're fairly good at this.
Thank you. Well, yeah, I bring project management skills and things I do professionally into it. I like doing it. It's what I don't know. I think the other piece too is, my dad worked in a creative industry growing up and owned his own business. And, I saw like one, how paying for your own health insurance sucks. It's so bad, in America. So just think about all the creativity and amazing things we could have if our society supported people's healthcare. And we didn't have to live in this society where a single health diagnosis, you know, I guess I forget the statistic. Let's go on a big, I'll have the medical debt Cloud Empress expansion.
We're getting too close to home there, bud.
most bankruptcies are, are related to medical debt, right? And most, folks who are unhoused or living in significant poverty have some medical debt connection. So anyway, I wanted to have health insurance. And I think the other piece too is, I saw how my dad, I don't want financial success to be tied to creative expression necessarily. That's something I think about, but when your livelihood depends on, like if my livelihood started to depend on this, I would start making probably different decisions.
Right.
I don't know what I would do, but I would start really pulling on tropes. I think in particular, I would do really bring it Bloodborne, right? Or From Software, I don't know. I would just start to bring in a lot more familiar elements, more so than I already do. And probably pander a little bit more. Because I'd just be so concerned about not making the money I need to make to live. And so I think right now, I do things to bring this to a wide audience that's important to me. But I don't feel, I am a little concerned. Like I wanted to make sure I'm feeling good about the campaign now, but there was this risk of like committing to this box set and then having way too few people do it and having to eat a lot of that cost, or I don't know what I would have done. So, I think having the freedom to step into and out of this work because my livelihood doesn't depend on it, it makes it a lot healthier for me.
Yeah, I could see that. That's very reasonable.
I mean, you got to have a balance with everything that you do. And, you know, so many people say, I mean, so few people, so few, I think way less people than people think live full time in TTRPGs and have this be their only job. Like,
Sure.
way less people than people think. Like, I genuinely think it's less than like 3-digit number, like in this current, especially this scene here.
Yeah.
But yeah, talking about the campaign, we have 17 days left to go. You're already at, I mean, the campaign's gone up like $300-$400 since we started this interview. You're at
It's because
pushing
of the show.
yeah, it's us
Come on,
live.
everyone, come on in.
But getting close to 900 backers, getting close to 75K, 17 days to go. You know, definitely already scratched on the door for six figures. A lot happening, a lot going on, a lot coming in the works, but stuff is already out now. Like you said, the we're getting redone hardbacks, but the game is still out there. It's still present. It's online to download. If people are interested in the project, which they absolutely should be, they should get all the stuff now for it. Where can they, like, what's your website? Where can people find the downloads that we've talked about for all the digital stuff online? Like, where can people find you so they can continue to follow, support, and check out Cloud Empress?
Sure. So cloudempress.com is the easiest place to find it. That links you to the campaign page. Cloud Empress Life and Death. Google search should find you the Kickstarter. And then Cloud Empress in DriveThruRPG, you'll find you a lot of stuff. One thing that someone asked about that I guess I've decided is that once we get in, once the campaign funds, the broader PDF send out for Land of Cicadas will happen towards the like when once orders are locked and stuff like that. But if people email me, I'll have an announcement about it. But people can email me and I'll send you the Land of Cicadas. So don't buy that if you're gonna back the campaign. Provided you back it at the right pledge level, right? So there are a couple pledges that include that book, but don't feel like you need to buy the PDF now. Just back it and then there will be a message out and I'll get that to you once the campaign's funded. Again, so you don't have to buy it twice or wait a year to get that PDF if you want to start playing now. And the other piece with the discount, I guess, just for folks to know, is it's not just people who have previously pledged, but also I'll have it at a certain point in the campaign. You know, if you take a picture of your print copy, that counts too, any of the previous materials. So I guess if it's at your local store or something, you want to buy it, you will get like that credit too towards the new materials. Again, the discounts for, it's always boring to talk about what the specifics of a discount are. So apologies everyone, but
No, it's important.
it's for if you're rebuying anything, right? So if you have the print rule book and you're getting something with the rule book in it, you get the discount. If you bought Land of Cicadas or some of the adventures and you're getting it again, then you get the discount. So cloudempress.com is probably the easiest way to find that, and then drive through RPG for all the links.
Awesome.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, listen, it is always a pleasure to have you here. For those listening, this won't be the last time you're on. It probably won't be the last time you're on this year. We'll see what's going on with that. But really excited to continue to support such an awesome creator, excited to see what's coming for Cloud Empress. We'll make sure that all the links that Watcha said are in the descriptions below, whether you're on podcast or VOD or whatever it is. And I'll try to remember to put the links to our previous episodes with the interviews, actual plays, second actual play, all the rest of that, so that you can check out Cloud Empress and you go back to the Kickstarter. 17 days left. If you're listening to this before April 25th, go back that. And And I think that's going to be it for us today. So, Walt, again, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Great to see you again.
Yeah. And we'll see all of you later. Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.